Hi, in this episode, Sarah and I are going to be talking about diagnosis. And I think when you first get your cancer diagnosis or you're waiting for it, I found to be one of the hardest bits of the whole last almost 2 years that I've been going through this whole journey. So I thought there'd be some really useful points that we could make, because I think Sarah and I actually have had some slightly different thoughts and approaches towards diagnosis. And I think a lot of you will probably really want help if you're going through this. And hopefully we can give some suggestions and some insights that just make you realize you're not the only one thinking perhaps what you're thinking, or clawing nails into your sides waiting for results, which I found the worst thing ever. Sarah, did you?
Absolutely. And I also hope that in this episode, we're able to help some people who might know somebody who is waiting.
Yeah.
I think that's a big thing. What on earth do you say to somebody to try and reassure them? You don't want to give false hope,
No. But
then you also don't want to be completely pessimistic.
No.
And it can be a really difficult time in for everybody, not just the person who is waiting. It's those that are around them who are aware of the situation as well. But yes, to answer your question, Jeremy, I was utterly terrified. I mean, that is the most, for me,
yep.
And I appreciate we keep saying different for everyone, but it was the most terrifying part, is that I knew there was a lump, so I knew there was a physical thing that was not okay. But at that point, until you're waiting for biopsies and various other things to come back, you're just not completely sure, and you just hope that it's okay. But then in this niggling bit in the back of your mind is telling you that, oh my God, you know, I've got cancer. And because of something that we're going to talk about in more detail, and is a running theme, I think, because of the way that cancer is depicted in the mainstream media and also in TV programs and stuff, you immediately catastrophize.
Of course.
What you don't realize is that there's people like us doing podcasts talking about what it means to actually live and really crack on a little bit with cancer. It's not, I mean, it's terrifying, but actually sometimes it's not quite as terrifying as you first think in those first few weeks whilst you're waiting.
Well, true. And I think you can do something about something when you know what that something is. But when you don't know whether you've got cancer, or you don't know how bad the cancer is, or you don't know what the treatment's going to be, you can't do anything. So I just felt so passive in that period, because I almost thought, I don't care if I've got it, I just want to know, because then I can deal with it. I can get an operation, or I can do radiotherapy or chemotherapy. I want to do something and sort this out. But I'm just sitting at home wondering if I've got it. Everyone else wondering too, as you point out. You're taking on everyone else's stress as well. I just wanted to know so I could get on and sort it out if possible.
So
you had a lump, and then, and we talked about this briefly before, what did you do when you had the lump? What did you have to wait for initially? What was that first wait for?
So it was a biopsy.
Yeah.
Essentially, that they do for breast cancer, usually. I believe that is normal for breast cancer. So you go to the clinic, either they've found a mass on a mammogram for people who are having mammograms, or indeed, in my case, you know, you could feel the lump. So they do, what they did with me rather, is a biopsy that's guided by an ultrasound machine. So
right.
They're sort of, that's how they make sure they're in the right place. And then in my case as well, they place something called a clip into it. So it's like a marker that they can see it. So that when you go on to have treatment, that then means that they can keep an eye on where the mass was.
Oh, I see.
On scans, you know, if the chemo is really successful and reduces it. And I must say, my first round of chemo was incredibly successful. And it reduced what was a 23 millimetre mass down to, I think it was 0.3.
Oh, wow.
Mil. So it really reduced it. But I still had the bilateral mastectomy.
Of course.
But I know that's on to treatment.
Well, it is. But it may obviously all singes together. But when you went to see the doctor and you had the lump and then they sent you off the biopsy, how quick or slow was that process?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting thing, and something that, you know, Jeremy, that I feel quite strongly about. I think it's because I'm a bit of a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely have been one of these people who wants answers quickly and will definitely ask for those answers. Probably they are fed up of me at the breast clinic in Lancaster, trying to get them on speed dial.
Fair enough.
But ultimately, I believe it's supposed to be 2 weeks.
Okay.
So from the point of you seeing your GP, it's then 2 weeks until the clinic would see you, and then another 2 weeks until you would get some sort of results that would then provide you with a treatment plan of sorts. With me, I must say, I was blown away by how quickly my GP referred me. I was in, that was like a Friday, and I was in a clinic on a Tuesday.
Oh, wow,
so
okay.
It was unbelievable. But I think they could sense, I was terrified.
Were you?
The sheer terror.
God,
really,
yeah.
I truly was.
Yeah.
So I think they could sense that as well. I don't know what bearing that had on
sure.
my time frame, but I felt like...
You were how old when?
35.
35, okay. So you're incredibly young.
Well... Yes, I mean, there's people younger than me
of
that
course.
Breaks my heart when I hear about childhood cancers and everything. You know, there's no right age
no.
as far as I'm concerned. It's horrible for everybody.
So just to clarify, how long from feeling the lump, first seeing the GP, to someone sitting down and say, Sarah, you've got breast cancer?
Well, I didn't even see my GP. He sent me to the clinic without seeing me based yep. on my analysis. But basically from that moment of speaking to my GP
yep.
to them saying it is cancer was around about just about 3 weeks.
Okay. All right. So that's yep. a tough 3 weeks, isn't it? That 3 weeks, as you said. Who did you tell, if anyone?
I told my mum.
Which must have been hard.
She was the first person that I even told that I had a lump. And then I told my partner at the time.
Yep.
And the reality is then everyone's terrified.
Of course.
You know, people can try and be calm and positive and stoic and hopeful. But the reality is everybody is terrified, and you can see it in each other's faces.
Of course.
But you're all trying to be as positive as you can. And it's just such a difficult period of time waiting. And I think they know that. I think that the NHS, particularly on their pathways, they are aware of that. But also in that time, I think a key message and tip for me to share with people listening would very much be around try to stay away from Google
yeah.
during that period. There's not a great deal, certainly in that period, of good that can come
true.
From it. And I also think that if you know people perhaps who have had recent experience with cancer or a cancer diagnosis, it can be useful to reach out to them because
true.
They might be able to just give you a sense of calmness. And there were a few people, a very good friend of mine, Heather, and another lovely lady who lived in a village close to both of us who sure. I didn't know well. And her name was Jen, and we didn't know each other, but she was really lovely and just calmed me a little bit. She didn't try and take away from the diagnosis
no.
or potential diagnosis, but she just tried to alleviate some of that terror.
You kept it in quite a small, tight group at this stage?
Very much
before
so.
You knew more, yeah.
Because I think the hardest part, and it would be really interesting to hear your experience about this, Jeremy. But for me, it's how do you also disseminate that kind of information? Because you actually haven't got any information.
Right.
The information you have is, I have a lump. And if you haven't got any symptoms, that's a whole different ballgame.
Of course.
So actually, in my situation, I had a lump. But what am I actually telling anybody? I might have cancer. So what does that mean? So actually, I think initially it was very, very close.
Yeah.
And that works for me. I know some people feel completely
different. Of course,
different.
I want to share with lots of people. That helps them.
Mm. So for you, in terms of sharing that journey,
yeah.
did you share it early on?
Well, early on, because it was quite a long process, my diagnosis, in a way. Because as I mentioned, I did the PSA test and the doctor said, your PSA is a bit high. And I didn't really know what the PSA was. And also, I just thought, it'll be fine. So what? You know, who cares? And then when they did the scan, he said, there's a shadow or there is something on your prostate. We need to look further. And even then, I kind of didn't take it too seriously. And in fact, he rang to tell me that just as I was about to board a plane to a wedding. So it wasn't the best time to get that sort of news. But I think it was when they said, you need to go and have a biopsy. And that's for me when it all became a bit scary. Partly because I'm, as you were saying, avoid Google, but I did want to know what was involved in the prostate biopsy. And, you know, it involves your legs being in stirrups, guns being shoved into your prostate, and it's painful. There's no pretending. And even the people who are doing it say, I'm so sorry, this is really going to hurt. And so I was dreading it so much, just the whole thought of it. And when I initially turned up for my first biopsy, having sort of slightly psyched myself into it, they said, I'm so sorry, the machine's broken, we've had to postpone it, you'll be going to a different hospital in a few days'
no.
time. And that really triggered me. I just found that so hard to deal with.
Yeah.
And then I started grinding my teeth. And I really, really ground my teeth while waiting for the biopsy the second time round. On the day of the biopsy, I woke up and I was in agony, like a toothache. I thought, God, something terrible's happened here. So I rang the dentist and said, I'm in absolute screaming pain. I've got a biopsy this afternoon. Can I just come and see if you get an emergency appointment for me? And said, yeah, come in straight away. And I've broken a really good tooth. It just cracked because I've been pressing it so much. So they had to pull the tooth out, which was agony. And it bled everywhere. And then I went straight from there, having had a local anaesthetic with blood dry my mouth, straight to the hospital to have another local anaesthetic in a different part of my body and then have the biopsy. And I think that period was my worst in the whole journey so far. The waiting, because a bit like you, I'm a bit of a control freak. I think we all control freaks on our own bodies up to a point, aren't we? And I couldn't do anything about it because I didn't know what was happening, and I didn't know if it was good cancer or a light sprinkling of cancer or a bad, like, you just don't know. So I hadn't a clue what to do, and not knowing what to do for me was really, really difficult. And I did tell people, but not too many people. But I sort of told people at the beginning because I thought it was going to be fine. And then, as you say, everyone was so lovely, but you get ping, 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 ping. What's that? Any news, any news, any news, any news. And I just found that really stressful because I didn't have any news. And it sort of stressed me that I didn't have any news. So,
well, it's a constant reminder, isn't it? Because the reality is, and I was going to ask you this about you boarding the plane to the wedding.
Yeah.
Is for me, I needed to be distracted. So by people being so wonderful but asking how I was on a daily basis, it's really difficult because I feel so lucky to have so many wonderful friends who would ask how I was. This is a little bit later for me down the journey. But actually, at points, I thought, I just want to pretend today that everything's okay and I don't want that constant reminder. So you were going to a wedding. Were you able to enjoy yourself?
So I did tell the person sat next to me on the plane, who's a very old friend of mine, Maria, and I did tell her what was going on, but then I didn't tell anyone else because I didn't want to be Debbie Downer at the wedding. Mm-hmm. and spoil everyone's time. And a bit like you, I hadn't really processed it myself. Yeah. So I couldn't talk to anyone about it until I really knew how I felt about it. But I didn't drink much and I sort of automatically tried to be healthier. Or even anyone told me that I needed to be. So I didn't share it too much at the beginning. But I think it's quite important too, if you feel comfortable with sharing, particularly men, because men never share anything. We don't talk to each other about our health. We don't talk to each other about our prostates. We don't talk to each other about our health or psychology quite a lot. So it's really important for men to share a bit more.
I think it's, as with all things that we talk about on this podcast, an individual decision. However, I agree with you in the sentiment for everyone, not just men, women as well.
Absolutely.
I think there's two core parts. There's the physical side of cancer and cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment, but there's the mental side of cancer. And truly, if you have the opportunity to have some support beyond the medical professionals at doctor and clinical level, sure, but also at organizations like Macmillan and other brilliant organizations that are out there, it will help over time. Great. I think that's the important thing.
I think so. And actually, what I found quite useful was cancer charity websites like Macmillan or Cancer Research UK or Prostate Cancer, because it was sort of advice from someone you didn't know, and that's sometimes easier. Or even looking at forums or talking to other people who've been through it who you don't know, because it was quite nice just escaping and not having to protect your friends or your family. And you could actually ask searching, proper, sometimes rather lethal sounding questions. I found that much easier to ask of strangers and charity helplines and forums and actually friends of mine. So that those could be hugely useful, I thought.
I agree, because rather than Google, you should seek out those organisations, because in the most part, they are fact checked. Exactly. And that's really important. There's a lot of statistics, and statistics, as you and I both know, can also be quite daunting. But fundamentally, you find yourself in a situation where there is more factual information. Google is an amazing tool, but just
you
not,
go down the
not when you're, yeah, you're waiting for that. And also, I made a big mistake. I decided to take it upon myself to try and become some sort of scientist.
Yeah.
So I started to try and read very detailed medical journals, because I was like, well, okay, if it's a medical journal, it must be right. But the reality is, I'm not a scientist, so I can't interpret that information accurately enough. And it can do one of two things: either terrify you more or give you false hope, which I also think can be quite damaging. I'm positive. You know me.
Yeah, yeah.
I am super positive. But false hope is also a dangerous thing.
Well, it is. And there's almost too much information out there, isn't there? And you don't know the details, particularly at the beginning of your own diagnosis. And yeah, you do go down the rabbit hole. I did do tons of research and I did buy loads of books. And almost there was too much information and my mind just got fuddled. And I think the other thing with telling your friends and family is all of them, or many of them, helpfully will say, oh, I know someone and he had prostate cancer and he's absolutely fine now, which is good to hear, of course. Mm. But you don't know if it's like yours. And a lot of people said, oh, you can live forever with prostate cancer and not even know you've got it, which is true. A lot of people can have a low-level prostate cancer when they're a bit older and they're going to die of something else before the prostate. But then a lot of people don't. And I sort of kind of thought, I think mine's the slightly worse one from what people have been telling me. So
I totally get it. Yeah. And I think it's so hard because you feel really ungrateful. And if anybody is listening, my friends and family, I am so grateful for all of you.
I know. It's so hard for them.
But it's so hard to get right because ultimately they just want us to feel better. So try and give us some positivity and hope. But also there's an element of you that wants the realism, because all in the while you're trying to plan your life. You know, yeah. How long am I going to be here? What does that look like? What's important to me now? These sleepless nights that are part of this waiting for the diagnosis are just unbelievable.
No, they are. And you want to be cheery for everyone else. But also I remembered, and we've talked before about my friend Ruth, I think about her a lot just because she died so young and I loved her very much. But I remember at supper at her house when she said, oh God, I've got this lump on my breast. And I said, oh God, it'll be nothing. And of course, it killed her. And I've always remembered that. And so I'm always very cautious about saying to people, oh, it'll be nothing, because I don't want to jinx it. So perhaps it's best not to say it at all, because false hope or cheery ignorance can be actually a little bit annoying in a strange way.
Yeah. And this goes back to another theme that I think is going to run through pretty much every episode. And that is that another piece of advice for people listening would be ask the person how they want to be.
Yes,
about
that's a really
cancer.
Good idea. Actually.
You know, how do you feel about it? It's always a good question to open with. But also, how should we talk about it? Some people might say, I don't want to talk about it at all. Some people might say, I want to be really jovial and upbeat and positive. I only want to hear the good stories. Mm. Some people might say, share everything with me. Let's just talk about it in a really honest and raw way. That's down to the individual. So I think for me, a really key point to come out of this episode, key message is, if you're helping somebody or you know somebody who is awaiting a diagnosis, it's a good idea to ask them how they want to go about it rather than just assume.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good idea. And I wish I'd thought of that.
They might not know.
No.
That's another thing.
But it's a good thing to ask.
But at least then they might start thinking about what they want to do. And that should hopefully really help.
I think so. Because some people actually just sometimes want empathy. They don't want positiveness. They don't want a constructive idea. They just want empathy.
Absolutely. So another thing that I wondered, when you were going back for appointments to hear about your diagnosis after you'd had your PSA and then your biopsy, did you go to that appointment with somebody? Did you have some questions already preset? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the advice is always to take someone with you because you don't remember everything that you're told, particularly early on when you're being told quite sort of dramatic news sometimes. And I think that's right. And Simon, my husband, came with me to most of those appointments. A little bit of me, because I'm weird, wanted almost no one to be there because I didn't want to worry about anyone else worrying about the news. I sort of felt it was going to be not great news. And I almost didn't want to have to worry about anyone else. I just wanted to focus on the not great news. Mm-hmm. But what they did very well, when I got the biopsy results at Lancaster Hospital, it was quite brutal, actually. The man who gave me the results said, I'm afraid you've got an aggressive high-grade cancer. And that was a bit of a shock, because I knew I had cancer, but I didn't realise. I wasn't expecting to say it's an aggressive high-grade. And I thought, oh, typical me, of course it is. And then he said, but hopefully it hasn't metastasized, but we now need to go and check that it hasn't gone to your bones. And of course, I didn't really know about metastatic cancer. And for anyone who doesn't know, basically what it means is your original cancer spreads to other parts of your body. And sadly, when that happens, it can be treated, but it can't be cured. Mm-hmm. So with prostate cancer, often it goes to the bones. Then it's still, even if you have bone cancer, it's still called prostate cancer because it's the prostate cancer in your bones. But all that's quite a lot to take in at the time. And then I just remember slightly phasing out when he started talking about cancer of the bones, and then phasing back in again. He was saying, but you know, of course, the bones could start to crumble because it could give you osteoporosis of the bones. But we could put metal rods in and they will help strengthen your spine and that'll make the pain less severe. And that was just, I think he gave me too much information at that first meeting. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to have metal rods. I'm going to be in pain, because he talked about pain quite a lot. So I was a little bit aghast. But then the very good thing they did was you go straight to see someone else, and her role or his role is to talk you through what you've just been told. Mm-hmm. And that's when you take it in, because she tells you it again in slightly softer language, I have to say, and also gives you numbers. And so that bit was really clever way, is sort of the sub-meeting after the main news.
And I think it's really important to take someone with you. I do agree with you. If you're able to, there will always be the consultant and another representative, medical representative in the room anyway. But you're right, because some of those words, I got the A word as well, the aggressive word. That is awful.
It is, because cancer's bad enough, but to have an aggressive cancer seems, great. Oh, really?
Yeah. And actually, it sends you into what I can only describe as a flat spin. Mm. You said you phased in and out. Everything stops. The world is just becomes a completely different place in that exact microsecond that you hear aggressive cancer as a phrase. Yeah. I think what was interesting is then I then moved into another room like you, and they talked about it in a slightly different word, which was
slightly more layman's terms.
Well, actually, they said, you know, this is a faster growing. Mm-hmm. So, okay, look, it's still not great, but aggressive just sounds
brutal.
There's certain words, isn't it? And it's like the phrase you just used as well about metastatic. Mm. That's an absolutely dreadful word as well.
Yeah.
I know it's the medical term, it's the accurate medical term, but the whole treatable, not curable is a much better way to describe that. And there are people wandering around everywhere you look with treatable but not curable cancer that have been living brilliant lives for many, many years. Yes, there are others who have sadly passed away.
Of course.
But there's lots of different outcomes here, and I think it's really important.
It is important
to remember that.
That they present all. I mean, they do have to tell you the truth, because you could complain if they don't. So they've got to be very careful, and you do have to paint it as is up to a point. But also in that second meeting, I slightly phased out, and she's talking about the different treatment options. And of course, you don't know much about those treatment options at that stage. And she said, and of course, you know, this might happen and this might happen if you do this and you do that. But don't worry, we can order you a penis pump, and that can be delivered to your local chemist. And I didn't know why would I want a penis pump? And I did not want it going to my local chemist. It's a nice little village chemist. Hello, has my penis pump come in, please? That's just not what I wanted. And I didn't understand what she was talking about. So it's a lot of information to take in very quickly. Mm. And they sometimes assume that you know more than you do.
I think that's right. And it's because it's like all of us in our given professions, we talk a lingo, don't we? Because we talk about it day in, day out. Whereas obviously for us, this is first time we're really hearing about this. So it can be really daunting, all the language and the different ideas and things that they talk about. What I do know about the NHS is they've actually stopped using acronyms now.
Oh, good.
Because of that. Because obviously acronyms are really easy to use in internal communication, but completely unhelpful in external communication. So I do know, certainly the Morecambe Bay Health Trust have stopped the use of acronyms.
That's a good idea. The other thing I would try and keep an eye on if you can is, because that whole process from the initial scan to the biopsy results, to them finding out if it was in my bones, which thank God it wasn't, was probably 3 or 4 or maybe even 6 weeks. It was a long time to be waiting for all this news. Mm. But also the thing that I was unlucky in, again, I was like you, I was in the Morecambe Trust, is I had one appointment at Westmorland Hospital, I had another appointment at Lancaster Hospital, then I had another meeting at Barrow Hospital. And it was really discombobulating seeing different people at different hospitals with quite large mileages between them, because then you never felt that anyone really quite knew what was happening with you. So try and make sure that all your treatment's confined, if possible, to one hospital. Mm-hmm. Or at least 2. I found that not a great experience.
That will very much depend upon where you are in the country. I know that the Morecambe Bay Health Trust have got a very particular set of challenges based on the
geography
of the region. Yeah. I just want to go back to another sort of tip and advice note, really, is if you are going to receive some results and you've got that appointment booked in, and likewise, if you are accompanying somebody, little stuff, pen, paper, some questions that you've maybe discussed that you definitely want to ask. One of the things that helped me was when I was leaving an appointment was to say, if I have any more questions, where should I direct them? Because I knew that if I left that appointment, there was going to be more questions. It was undoubtedly, usually by the time I'd got to the car park.
Always, exactly. Right?
And then you'd think, oh, well, I can't go back in. No. But knowing immediately where to get those questions rather than the immediate, oh, I'll Google it. So you need that outlet and you need to understand the key people in your journey as early as possible.
That's a really good point. They are so valid and valuable. And I was given, it wasn't a cancer coordinator, but that was more or less the role. So I was given someone who I could always call, who would always knew the details of my particular condition. And she was a godsend. It was so great that there was a person with a name and number whose card you had that you could ask all those questions of. That was really important, I think.
Excellent. Okay. Well, there's a few other things that I wanted to raise, because one of the other parts of this, we talked about who did we tell individually, some people close to us. But one of the difficult things, I think, in that period of waiting is work.
Yeah.
Most of us go to work and you're trying to do a good job, probably, and be focused. But that is incredibly difficult when you've got this niggling thing in your head. Now, work can be a good distraction.
I was going to say it can be a very good distraction sometimes.
But it's not for everyone. How did it go for you? Were you what were you doing?
Well, I was consulting at the time, so I'd just finished a big sort of 10 years in an office role. So I was working from home, which made it easier. Mm-hmm. So I did carry on doing the work, and I did find it quite a good distraction, if I'm honest. Okay. But I think often if you have good colleagues in an office, they're quite good sounding boards sometimes. I mean, it's quite soon that you know what your treatment plans are, and that's when you do have to bring it into the office, whether you want to or not, because you're going to be taking time off work. And then I think you have to share it. And in my experience, and those I know who've been through cancer, their colleagues and their officers and their bosses have been pretty brilliant with it. I wish that was for everyone, but what about you?
I am self-employed, so whilst it's not been without its challenges in different ways, I'm still working. At the time, it was really good because I could manoeuvre my diary, shall we say, around appointments.
But there is a lot of appointments at that stage, isn't there?
A lot of appointments. Yeah. The troubling bit for me was definitely because I was, as I keep mentioning, so terrified that actually being fully present in my roles and giving, you know, if I'm really honest, 100% to what I was doing, I was really struggling with that. I wanted to.
Of course.
That's how I operate in my professional life. But goodness me, it was hard. It was really hard.
And we'll talk about sort of work and cancer in another episode, because there's so many good things and bad things and conundrums and finances that you face. I think if it's any consolation to anyone who's going through diagnosis at the moment, that for me was the hardest thing of the entire process. Obviously, there's going to be hopefully just up points, but maybe for some people there are down points. But I think that initial shock and the initial waiting for me was one of the worst bits of having cancer. And hopefully that bit is quick and you get through it. But don't worry, not necessarily your entire journey with this illness or disease will be as frustrating and tense as that. I don't know if you feel the same.
Yes, I definitely haven't felt that terrified. Again, however, this is designed to be a very honest and raw depiction of our personal experiences. And for me, I still get an intense amount of fear when it's time for my quarterly scans.
Of course.
I had a scan just the other day, and there's absolutely no reason for it to be anything other than fine, an ovarian scan. But for that morning, I was really snappy, bit snarly, bit grumpy. With those that were close to me. And then when I was lying there having this scan, the fear and anticipation waiting for her to just tell me, oh, that looks okay. And she thankfully, touch wood, she said, that looks okay.
Oh, really? Straight away?
Straight away on that particular one. Yeah, it doesn't usually work like that. But I think we've built a relationship. I see her every quarter. And I have done for about 2.5 years. So we've got a bit of a bond now. But, you know, it's one of those just waiting and waiting and waiting. So if you think about that fear... In that 5-minute window of her doing that scan, if you've then got to wait 2 weeks for those results.
Yeah, or six sometimes.
You know, it's really difficult.
It's hellish. And
so the scanxiety thing, which we're going to talk about in another episode, it's a real thing.
It is a real thing, and really tough for you, because in a way you've had 3 diagnoses, haven't you? You've been through this 3 blimmin' times.
Yes.
And it doesn't get easier, I imagine.
Not really. And I suppose you're a little bit more prepared for it as time comes along. I think I'm so unbelievably resilient. sometimes surprise myself. But I'd be lying if I said it was easy.
No, of course. Definitely, but you do get stronger as you go through it. And you get more knowledge that makes it easier for you.
Very true.
There's fewer people to tell, which sort of makes it easier. Everyone already knows mm-hmm. what's going on. And you've sort of looked into the darkest corners of what could happen. So you've not necessarily come to terms with it, but you know what could be there.
I think the word processing you used earlier is absolutely, so much processing is just done over time. You can't rush it. And certainly you're right. I've had 2.5 years to process cancer and all its good and bad points.
Well, yes. I mean, there are good points. We will talk about those in another episode. And perhaps if we finish off with the other question that does go through your mind at this stage is the title of our podcast series, How Long Have You Got? And you think about that quite early on, don't you? Because as soon as the possibility of an illness that can kill you comes into your mind, you think, oh, God, what if I don't have long to live? What if I do have long? I just don't know. And you sort of try to avoid asking yourself the question. And you know your friends and family are also asking the same question, even when it's still an early stage of your cancer. But the how long have you got? The thing is, at any stage, no one really knows. The doctors don't know. As we've talked, it's just statistics. It's just averages. So you kind of have to put that to the side. But don't worry for it popping into your head. That's just normal.
Absolutely. Every single person is going to approach this in a different way and have different feelings. But hopefully we've given you some ideas on this podcast of things that you can do to mitigate it slightly. And that is just, you know, lean on your support, but be really straight with them about what you want. Think about who your key points of contact are. Find out their details. Think about the questions you want to ask. Don't be afraid to ask any questions. Don't be afraid to pester a little bit if you need to find out what you need to find out. And whatever you do, stay away from Dr. Google. That's my big one for this right now.
I know. I didn't. I lived on it, which is dangerous.
I know. I get it. Some people need that information, but I think it could be wrong. And I think that's a really important part. And
true.
Just got to be careful. Don't stay away. Be careful.
Well, that's true. And as always, we'll have links and charities that can help you if you're going through this now on our Instagram. How long have you got? 2024. So any questions or anything you think we can do to help, please do let us know.
Thanks.